The date is July 20th, 1984, and we're watching The Neverending Story. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
And welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
Now, last week in our Mortal Kombat episode, we talked a little bit about our website, which is now up and fully operational, so go check that out, iusedtolikethisone.com. On the site, you'll see that part of the inspiration for creating this show came from a friend's social media post. He had showed this movie to his daughter, and she thought it was terrible. So this is the movie he was talking about. Today, we are joined by that man via Zoom, special guest Martin Galba. Hello, Martin.
Hello, and I feel so honored that I, contributed something to the world, to the big wide world out there by being an inspiration for your amazing show here. So thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So your daughter, so this I'm assuming then must have been one of your favorite movies when you were a child or something like that.
Absolutely. To the point that, so we, let's go back, I want to say 20 some years, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty close, right? And so in my hometown, we had a VHS rental store, and I would put my name on the waiting list, and I would wait for the VHS to be available, and so they would call me up, and I would rush in every chance I would get. I would put the 20 kronen down so I could rent it for a couple days, and then one glorious day, my friend Libor acquired a very special unit that allowed me to have my very own copy of the VHS tape so that I could have it forever and ever and ever again.
Arr, matey, I think I understand what you're saying. Arr.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so, I mean, you mentioned Kronar. Now, I know you speak multiple languages. Is German one of them? Like, are you watching the original German version of Neverending Story? Because in my research, I discovered that the German version is like 10 minutes longer than the American version.
No, actually, we watched it with Slovakian dubbing.
Okay.
So, yeah, a lot of the big popular movies would be dubbed. And so luckily we got a chance to watch them in our own languages. So, but some of them that weren't all that known or all that popular in Europe, we would get them in English, and then there would be just translations on the bottom, subtitles. Yeah. So this one luckily was dubbed. So
now, okay, so you have these fond memories of this movie. And so recently you showed it to your daughter then. All this lockdown, show some of your past to your daughter.
Yes, and so I was looking at all of the streaming sites, and none of them had it. So we ended up paying $5 for it through, I don't know which, Shaw TV or something. And I was so excited. We made it a whole movie night. I said, Cassidy, this is my ultimate childhood movie. You will absolutely love it. There's a flying dog in it. There's a guy that eats rocks. There's a snail. There's a princess. And there's a guy that reads a book. Like, you have all of the components of a brilliant story. Now, this is what I remembered, right, as from my childhood. And then we sat down and started watching the movie.
Yeah.
The commentary that went on, I should have recorded the commentary. It was hilarious. I kept getting slammed. Cassidy was like, you said this was an amazing movie. This is crap. This is bad. Daddy, this is a bad, horrible movie. I said, do you want to watch the second part? There's a second part. She said, absolutely not.
Oh, there's 2 hours. Parts. Did you know there's three parts?
Yeah. She said, no, because this is 2 hours of my life that I'll never get back. So.
Well, okay, let's start talking Neverending Story here then. So this week, we're looking back at July 1984, when the movies and theaters were Bachelor Party, Supergirl, Ghostbusters, Karate Kid, Last Starfighter, episode 5 of our show, and of course, our movie for today, The Neverending Story, which earned $100 million on a $27 million budget.
And it should go without saying, but I'm going to say it anyways, if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, we are going to be talking about it in depth, so if you want to wait, press pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what Sean and Martin and I have to say about it.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "A boy who needs a friend finds a world that needs a hero in a land beyond imagination." Now, I left pauses in there, but there's actually no punctuation in this tagline. But there is an exclamation point at the end. So, "A boy who needs a friend finds a world that needs a hero in a land beyond imagination." But that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
It's funny because my 60-second synopsis, I think, perfectly fills in all the gaps of your pauses. So this, my synopsis is, "The Neverending Story is the story of a kid named Bastion reading a story about a kid named Atreyu who has been tasked with saving the world of Phantasia from an overwhelming dark force known as the Nothing."
Right on. So, for me, I'm kind of like Martin, where, like, this is one of those movies where I remember the dog dragon, like, Falcor, I remember all that sort of stuff. And this seems like one of those ones that must have shaped my childhood in some way. But I don't know what I was thinking. I think I may be remembering this movie a little more fondly than I should have. But it seems like it's one of those that should absolutely just be ingrained in the lexicon of somebody that was raised in the 80s. You know, this is kind of like the Goonies. This is one of those ones that you have to have seen if you were raised in the 80s. But on that note, Colin, what's your experience with The Neverending Story? Is this one that we caught you on again, or had you actually seen this one?
So, The Neverending Story is interesting because I remember it. I remember at least seeing parts of it. I don't know that I ever sat down and watched it the whole way through.
Okay.
Literally, the only thing I remember about it is the flying dog. And but for, I don't know, it came out in 1984. So, like, for the 34 years I've been alive, my, like, memory of the Neverending Story is that I hate it.
Yeah.
I've always just felt, whenever somebody brings up that movie, I just think, ugh, I hate that movie. Even though I don't remember actually watching it, but still, that's kind of my experience with it.
Alrighty, let's jump into The Neverending Story. Directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who is known for Das Boot, Outbreak, the 2020 story, Enemy Mine, Air Force One. It's executive produced by Mark Damon, who is an actor and a producer. He produced Das Boot, Short Circuit, Flight of the Navigator, 9.5 Weeks, and has a whole bunch of acting credits. And it's written by Wolfgang Petersen, Herman Weigel. I don't know. I have to take a guess. I'm assuming it's German. Yeah, you look at his IMDb and it's a whole bunch of German films I can't pronounce. So it's pretty safe to say that it's whatever the German pronunciation of that is. It's also written by Robert Easton, who gets an additional dialogue credit. He's another one that has like 151 acting roles, but he only has one other writing credit for a movie called The Giant Spider Invasion. And Michael Endy gets the novel credit. It's kind of embarrassing to realize that I was today years old when I realized that this was a book. I was going to ask,
did you guys know that it was a book? I had no idea.
No, I've only heard of it as a movie. And as a matter of fact, I only knew of the two movies. Is the third one with Jack Black? Is that the one?
Yes. Yeah. I had to laugh when I saw that credit. I don't think I've ever seen the third one. I remember the second one has the Sequest guy. What's his name? Jonathan Brandis is the Bastion in that one, I believe. Yeah, I was surprised to find out that it was a book. Or at least a book before it was a movie.
Yeah, the book came out in 79, I want to say. And, like, fun fact I found in my research is that the author, Michael Endy, actually, he hated the film.
I read
He
that too.
hated the film so much that he didn't want to have his name placed in the opening credits.
Yeah.
So they ended up putting it at a small little spot in the back. And he also tried to sue the production company to get them to change the name so that it wouldn't be affiliated with. No one would look at the movie and be like, "Oh, that's based on that book."
Well, yeah. I mean, I wish I had found out much further in advance to doing this podcast. I might have actually read it just to see how much different it was. One of the things I found out is, for some reason, in the novel, it's called Fantastica instead of Fantasia. Like, why they decided to change it to Fantasia for the movie, unless they're trying to get some of that sweet Disney bank and. Hoping that by calling it Fantasia, you're going to affiliate it with, the Sorcerer's Apprentice and stuff like that. But so we open the Neverending Story on the theme song, which is just such an earworm of a song. It's one of those ones that you're singing for days afterwards, and we're flying over clouds. And this is shortly followed by Bastion waking up with a start, sitting up in his bed. And Bastion is played by Barrett Oliver, who he was in Daryl, Cocoon 1 and 2, and not much else. His last credit was in 1989. Then we're in the kitchen, and Bastion is sitting at the table trying to open a jar of jam when his dad, Gerald McCraney, who of course was from Simon and Simon, Major Dad, Promised Land. He has a lot of recurring roles in his IMDb. He's had several episodes of Deadwood, Longmire, Mike and Molly, House of Cards, 24 Legacy. But Dad comes in and makes himself an OJ and egg smoothie. Doesn't that look delicious, guys? Like, have you ever had just orange juice and egg? That's all it is. Orange juice and raw egg.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that that was some kind of diet fad in the 80s.
It totally was.
Because, like, he... And Gerald McCraney, I mean, good for him. He slams that back. He actually drinks it. No edits of the camera. And he has cracked an egg into this orange juice, and he just drinks it up. I mean, you know, him and Sylvester Stallone, got to give them credit for drinking eggs on camera. But he opens up the jar for Bastion, and then they start having a heartfelt chat about missing Bastion's dead mom and drawing horses in his math book, which his dad thinks are unicorns. But Bastion corrects him and says, no, they're horses. You know, his delinquency at school, he's late and not trying out for the swim team. Dad seems to be
disappointed,
very disappointed in all this. And then it's kind of, okay, good chat. Don't be late for school. You know, and Bastion complains that, well, I wasn't late yesterday, as if he needs a hero medal for that one. But before we leave the kitchen, we look around and we see strategically placed groceries. And I get to do a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. Now, always on the lookout for blatant product placements in these older movies, this is basically the only scene that shows products. So here we go. Neverending Story is brought to you by Ziploc Sandwich Bags, Wonder Bread, Skippy Peanut Butter, Sankey Coffee, and Levi's Jeans. This has been Sponsorship Corner.
I don't think there's a Sponsorship Corner we've done yet that doesn't have Wonder Bread.
Yeah, I'd have to say so. So now we've left the kitchen. Bastion is on his way to school, and he's accosted by three bullies who chase him down to try to roll him for his lunch money. When he doesn't have any, they throw him in a dumpster. He gets out, and all the bullies say, "Hey, we didn't say you could come out of the dumpster." So he gets chased again. And this time he hides in a bookstore where the owner states he doesn't like kids. Like, what a greeting for this guy that's just trying to hide from bullies. The first thing that the guy says to him is, "I don't like kids." And also tells him that the arcade is just down the street. So the owner of the store is Carl Conrad Coriander. A name we never hear, as far as I can actually remember. Do they ever actually say Coriander's name?
No.
No?
I don't think they do now.
Yeah, and in like Neverending Story 2 and 3, like the character comes back, but they just credit him as Coriander at that point. So this is the only movie where we get the alliteration of Carl Conrad Coriander. But he is played by Thomas Hill, who was also in the movie The Nude Bomb. I remember that movie. That was one that it was the...
The Nude Bomb?
The Nude Bomb, yeah. It was kind of like The Naked Gun, but it was the Get Smart characters. It was a Get Smart movie. He played the president in that. He was also in The Postman Always Rings Twice, 33 episodes of Newhart. This is the credit of his that I found very interesting. He played Uncle Owen in Star Wars, the original radio drama, which in the early 80s, I guess radio dramas was something that you still did. But yeah, he played Uncle Owen. And when I was looking through the credits of that particular radio drama, the only people that were actually in the movie that appeared in the radio drama were Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, and Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, and everyone else was played by someone else, which I found hilarious. Now, Bastion, in order to convince Mr. Coriander that he likes books, Bastion starts listing off some of the 186 books he owns. How many things do either of you guys own that you know the exact number of? Like, unless it's a ridiculously small number, like, I know I own one car. I know I own three mattresses. I mean, like, things that you collect. How many things do you... Like, let's look at pirated VHS tapes, Martin. How many pirated VHS tapes did you ever own when you were growing up? Do you... Like, is there anything like that that you guys know the exact number of?
No, not the exact number. I know I have a huge DVD and Blu-ray collection, mm-hmm. and that takes over two massive IKEA bookshelves. Ugh. And then I also have a massive VHS collection that I've inherited. It consists of all of the oldies musicals and all the, it's a massive collection that I'm not wanting to get rid of, but I don't know the exact number, so yeah, kudos to the little kid for
I guess this is something you did as a kid, is you memorized exact numbers of things like that. So Mr. Coriander is busy reading a mysterious book that he says to Bastion, forget about it, this book is not for you. And when the phone rings, he hides it under a newspaper when he gets up to answer the phone, and sure enough, Bastion takes it, but leaves a note promising to bring it back. Did either of you interpret the smile that Mr. Coriander gives him at this point? It's this sly little smile on his face that makes me think, okay, this was planned.
I was gonna say he wanted Bastion to take the book.
Yeah, he's reverse psychologizing him.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have a story, right?
So exactly. I suppose so. Yeah. Bastion arrives at school, sees that there's a math test, decides fuck this shit, and goes to hide in the attic of the school instead. I'm impressed that he remembers to take the key with him. I know I was watching that scene where there's like a close up of the door closing with the key in it. And I thought, oh, does he forget to take the key? Is that how he's found out? Like, I couldn't remember the movie well enough to know if he was found out. And then he reaches around and takes the key out. I was impressed that he remembered it. And apparently this attic is where they keep shit like human bones?
Well, science labs.
Science stuff.
Science dioramas and stuff.
But I don't know. I guess the Goonies attic is no longer the most messed up attic that we've covered on this show, because like this is a den of nightmares that he's just walked into. I mean, but he pulls up an old gym mat to lay down on and starts reading, and we are now into the book. So we start off the book. We see the giant rock biter. Okay, now I found this movie to be a tough one to do some research on. So this is where it starts to get a little confusing. So the Rockbiter is voiced by Alan Oppenheimer, who also voices Falcor,
yeah.
Morik, and the narrator. This guy, he's got like 317 credits, but it's mostly cartoon and video game voice work. So he rolls into a clearing where we see the top-hatted Teeny Weenie, who is played by Deep Roy. Deep Roy is in the Star Trek reboots. He plays that little Keenzer guy that hangs out with Scotty. He's in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Tim Burton one, where he's an Oompa Loompa, or he's all the Oompa Loompas, I guess. He has a real relationship with Tim Burton, though, because he's also in Big Fish, Planet of the Apes, Corpse Bride. Okay, so this is why I start getting confused here, because Teeny Weeny is dubbed by Frank Leonard. So Deep Roy doesn't even do his own voice, yet in Corpse Bride he does voice work. So I don't know why they decided that for this movie they needed to dub him. But yeah, this guy Frank Leonard, he usually dubs movies into German, but this is one of those cases where he dubbed it into English instead. But we also get the weird goblin Nighthob, who is played by Thilo Pruckner. Pruckner? I don't know, there's little umlauts over the U. And he's got 238 credits, and almost all of them are German. It's funny. Well, it's not funny, but he died July 2nd of this year. He died only a couple months ago. And normally I wouldn't have looked into cause of death, but as soon as I saw that he died earlier this year, I had to look it up and make... I was wondering whether it was complications from coronavirus or something like that. But it was natural causes, it said.
Well, that's good, I guess. If somebody's going to die, I guess. I'd rather they die of natural causes than coronavirus in 2020.
So these three, Teeny Weeny, Nighthob, and... Well, I guess... Only those two, Teeny Weeny and Nighthob, have set up a camp with their giant pad and their giant racing snail. And Rockbiter comes into the clearing, bringing the tale of the nothing that's destroying everything in Fantasia, or like I said, Fantastica in the novel. He talks about lakes and rocks just disappearing. Only one person can help us, the childlike Empress. So our bizarre menagerie of people are going to head to her home, the Ivory Tower. These are not terrible effects so far, though. I'm kind of impressed with the Rockbiter.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the puppetry on the Rockbiter for sure.
Yeah, and even once the racing snail starts up and zooms off and everything like that, it's not too terrible, you know. I don't know.
I mean, it's weird and inexplicable.
It's the whole beginning, I think, had a really cool kind of a makings of a really cool story, right?
Yeah,
this kid, and like all of that beginning was super. It kind of reminds me of how the Harry Potter movies always start with Harry in the real world, right, in London, and then and then all that world that world has to bring. And then I was always jealous of the attic that he had at his school, because we never had an attic like that to hide in or explore. And so all of that prep work was like, yeah, this is going to be a good movie. And then you get to this scene with the Rockbiter and the snail, and it's like, wow, cool. And then all the CGI, probably moving a little too far ahead, so you probably comment on the wonderful...
We'll get there. But yeah, I mean, this kind of shows you that the old adage of less is more is definitely worth talking about, because... You like Martin says, you have this big build up with all this exposition in the beginning of this movie, whereas you take a look at something like Princess Bride, where Grandpa just comes over and reads a book, you know, and that's it. You're just in the kid's room, no big setup to it, and it's a much better fantasy story once you actually get into the story, you know. Yeah. Maybe they should have, you know, I guess maybe Princess Bride looked at this movie and goes, well, we don't need all that backstory in the beginning. Kid's sick.
Well, it's kind of funny because two of my favorite 80s movies are Labyrinth and The Princess Bride. And then watching The Neverending Story, I felt like there was a lot of similar elements. Like, even the way the movie starts with the song and stuff, and like you said, the reading the book as they go along. But this movie, I think, because I didn't remember watching it as fondly as a kid, and now I'm looking back at it with more of a history of other movies I've watched, like, it reminded me a lot, even as they go towards the Ivory Castle or whatever to find out who's gonna save the world. It reminded me a lot of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I could see that, absolutely. So yeah, so we do get to the top of the ivory tower with the strange mix of characters standing around. I wish they had gone into a little bit more of who some of these people were.
Like, I really wanted to know who this, like, the weird face...
The four-faced people or the giant-headed guys, the elephants. I wish I remembered Never Ending Story 2 a little bit better to see whether characters like these make an appearance. Have you watched Never Ending 2 anytime recently?
No, not since back in the early 90s. So.
Okay, yeah, see, that might be one to visit down the road, but not too soon. I might get a little... over Never Ending Storied. You could do without it. And we get Charon addressing the crowd. He's played by Moses Gunn, and he did a lot of shows like Shaft's Big Score, Ragtime. He was in the movie version of Ragtime with you talking about musical theater a few minutes ago. Roots, Heartbreak Ridge, a Clint Eastwood movie, Firestarter, a lot of TV. He tells everyone that the Empress is ill because of the nothingness, and the only hope is Atreyu. And luckily, Atreyu shows up, and he's played by Noah Hathaway. He's got 32 credits. Battlestar Galactica was one of his biggest ones, where he played Boxy in Battlestar Galactica. It's interesting that you brought up Harry Potter a second ago. In the movie Troll, he played a character called Harry Potter Jr. So I don't know if I've ever seen the movie Troll, but there is a Harry Potter Sr. and a Harry Potter Jr. in that movie, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, when Atreyu shows up, he's just a kid, everyone protests. I did have to wonder at first, though, just because Atreyu seems very influenced by Native American culture and all this sort of stuff. And I guess the fact that he lives in Fantasia, it's not necessarily that he's supposed also to be, like, an indigenous person, but...
I mean, he's supposed to be green as well. That didn't pan out because
is that something from the novel?
Yeah, in the novel, okay. In the novel, like... Because it's a fantastical land, like he's like a green described as like a green skinned planeswalker.
Okay.
And I read that they tried to make him green in the movie, but the makeup that they used just ended up looking like moss. So they didn't they weren't really into it.
That would be terrible. But I was kind of curious because even when Bastion wakes up in the very beginning, he seems to have a fascination with indigenous culture as well, because he's got a native with a full headdress picture on his wall. And so they are clearly going for this kind of feeling with him. I tried to Google what his ethnicity is, and some sources I found that, you know, supposedly he has some native in him somewhere. I found one source that said that he's half Mohawk. So, I mean, it was one of those where for a second there, I was wondering whether they were, you know, getting someone to play outside of his race. But knowing that he was supposed to be green, then I guess all is forgiven anyway.
I mean, it's kind of interesting, even if you think about, like, Michael Ende, like, when he wrote the novel, like, I'm sure some of those themes were in there. And I mean, lots of times whenever... authors write stories about different alien races, they borrow from different cultures and kind of throw them in to define their different races. So yeah,
that's true.
It could have just been happenstance that because he ended up not being green, it now looks like a little bit of cultural appropriation.
Well, you know, you even look at someone like J.K. Rowling who gets heat for the fact that the trolls that work at Gringotts, or the goblins that work at Gringotts, are stereotypes of Jewish culture. You know, there's been some heat on her for that kind of thing, on top of all the other things that JK is getting heat for right now. But that's something that I guess they just kind of do in fantasy novels, is try to steal from certain stereotypes.
Oh, I just wanted to... throw a quick little comment on that. I think there is some sort of play on some sort of a native element in there. There is a script that was sent to me. It was an adaptation of the novel, a stage play adaptation. And there is a character, speaking of colors, there's a character of purple buffalo. and there's an elder as well from Atreyu's clan, I guess. So there's definitely some sort of an influence of that nature. So
yeah,
like I read I haven't read the book obviously, but for whatever reason, when I was doing research, I was reading like the different character descriptions, and the backstory of Atreyu is that his parents were killed by purple buffaloes.
Okay. Well, there we go. So, Atreyu is sent on his quest to find the cure for the nothing, but he's not allowed to bring weapons. That seems like a pretty significant stipulation to put on him, is no weapons allowed. But he is given the Orin Snake Knot Medallion, which is owned by Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg owns that prop, and it was, I guess, a thank you gift from Wolfgang Peterson for showing him how to edit it in a way that would be appealing to American audiences. He gave him one of the Orins as a thank you gift. But we then get a few minutes of watching Atreyu ride his horse, Artax. Like, just there's so many of these moments in the movies that, you know, at the beginning when we were saying that Falcor is one of the only things that we really remember about this movie, if you were to take out Atreyu riding the horse and Atreyu and Bastion flying on Falcor, that would take out like 15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Because they spend a lot of time focused on this horse riding scene, you know, on him on his journey across the country. But we receive the ominous narration over top of this horse riding of, meanwhile, elsewhere in Fantasia, a creature of darkness also begins his quest, which is the green glowing-eyed wolf thing, Gamorrek. Gamorrek was a little cheesy.
I was disappointed, very disappointed. I was expecting the dark creature to be something bigger than a small little wolf, right?
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of a, after everything we've seen, right? After we've seen all of these wide shots and all the different characters, and then there's just this little wolf that he's supposed to be fighting against. It's like,
Yeah, like, he's an impressive animatronic, but yeah, for something that is hyped up to be a creature of darkness, well, it's a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And his eyes glow a little bit.
Yeah.
We find out eventually that he can talk. That's a... Okay, little Red Riding Hood, run. He puts on his grandmother's dress later on. But we cut to Bastion, who decides that it's time to eat because Atreyu is in the book. And he takes a couple bites of his sandwich, then very seriously says to the sandwich, "No, not too much. Still have a long way to go." What the fuck? Why? I don't understand. Like, I've given movies that have video game playing a hard time about kids that don't know how to play video games very well. But who reads a book like this? Like, Bastion isn't very good at pretending to read a book.
Well, I would say it's the type of kid that knows he has 186 books in his shelf.
He clearly loves his book, so
takes it very seriously.
So he knows what his average time per page is. He's done the math in his head, even though he skipped out on the math test in the beginning.
Well, I think it says something that he goes to the attic of his school, not even his house, or like somewhere outside of both those places.
Yeah.
And basically hunkers down for the long haul. Like, the kid loves books,
really. Yeah, and it's, you know, gotta pace yourself, right? You gotta make sure that if things get really exciting, like, you know, when the horse dies, but I don't want to give away anything. I'm sure you'll
we're almost there. Yeah.
So, you know, you gotta give yourself a little bit of a fuel to get through all those moments. So,
of course,
having 180 books, he probably has enough experience in knowing how to pace his sandwiches and snacks.
I do appreciate the fact that in the beginning, when he's sitting in the kitchen, like, he's got Wonder Bread, Skippy peanut butter and his jam. He's got those all open and he is eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Obviously something you wouldn't get away with doing in a school in 2020, bringing a peanut butter sandwich through the metal detectors at the front of your school. But, you know, but at least there is a consistency that you can see that he obviously was making his lunch at the breakfast table as well. You know, while he was eating breakfast. But so we get more horse riding, and then Gamorrek is on the trail. Atreyu has decided that he's searched everywhere, so he should go find Shell Mountain and Morla, the Ancient One. But to get there, they have to trudge through the Swamps of Sadness. And Artax, the horse, is clearly sad because he starts sinking in the swamp. And that's what's supposed to happen if you're sad in the... That's what the swamp does to you, is it makes you drown.
Unless you're Atreyu and you're crying so hard about your dying horse, clearly sad, but somehow you still walk.
That's right.
Safely.
Absolutely. My very next note. Yeah, the horse drowns and Atreyu is screaming in frustration, but then he is super sad. Super sad. Yeah, shouldn't he be sinking now at this point? Like, I don't understand why these... Swamps of Sadness are so selective in who drowns and who doesn't.
That scene actually kind of gave me a little bit of anxiety watching it, because they let that horse sink pretty far down, and I was wondering, like, are we going to see it go all the way down somehow? But they cut, like, right when it's at,
right when it's at
the cheekbones.
Yeah, it was, I understand that. And actually, the horse was gifted to the... Noah Hathaway, and then he couldn't bring it back to America, so he ended up giving it to one of the stunt guys. But yeah, one of the Artaxes was gifted to him. So now Atreyu, even though he should have drowned in the swamps because he's so sad, he ends up finding Shell Mountain and he climbs it. But twist, Morla is the mountain because she is a giant turtle. I'm assuming she is Morla, a boy or a girl. I wrote down she. I think she's a she.
It seems like a she.
Yeah. But Morla is voiced by... Now, this is another one of those really confusing credits. Morla is voiced by Robert Jada, maybe? Because in the actual like credits, they list very few of the people that are actually in this movie in the credits. So I had to do some Googling. And I think he's either the voice of Morla in this, or he is in the series Tales of the Neverending Story. But there's also a cartoon Neverending Story, which it is a woman doing the voice, which is why I assume Morla is a woman. I don't get it. It's just this was a bit of a nightmare to Google. I'll admit that this was a tough one to research. But Bastion screams as soon as the giant turtle makes her appearance, and the people in the story react, and Bastion says, "No way, they couldn't have heard me." Again, this is a kid that screams when he's reading a book. Have you ever screamed reading a book? Either of you?
I haven't screamed, but I've laughed.
Oh, so. Yeah, see, there's that. But I mean, full on screaming, and no one in the school hears him either at that point. Like, but the other thing that blows my mind is that he has made this connection that, wait a minute, they heard me. I want to know what the text in that book says at that point that explains how they all reacted when he screamed. Well, Morla has been alone for far too long because she talks to herself by referring to herself as we, like she's the friggin' Queen of England. Lines like, "We don't even care whether or not we even care." Some of the lines that Morla has, I don't know whether they're profound or whether they're poorly translated. But yeah, as she keeps sneezing and blowing Atreyu out of the tree. Did you understand why she was sneezing? Was there something that they mentioned that she was allergic to that I missed?
No.
No? Okay. So Morla suggests that Atreyu can ask the Southern Oracle for advice, and the Southern Oracle is 10,000 miles away. So For perspective, we are in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and that would be the distance of Edmonton to Tehran, Iran. That nice. That's 10,010 miles away from where we are sitting right now recording this is Iran. So he's got a bit of a journey to go. And this is the point where the school is done for the day. The bell rings, but Bastion is like, nah, I'm just going to stay. Like, he didn't want to be there in the first place. Is the attic that much of a draw that he's, okay, I'll just stay here while everyone goes home. But even though at this point the lightning has started and it's frightening him, he still decides he wants to stay. But he says, no, Atreyu wouldn't quit now. So he decides to keep on reading. Attaboy, Bastion. So we're back to Atreyu trudging back through the swamp. And again, you'd think that he's even sadder at this point because he's found that his quest is nowhere near complete. And he's still not sinking. Or, well, I guess he does start sinking. I don't know about you, but watching Atreyu go through all these swamps, I just wanted to have a shower.
He does get pretty dirty.
That's like the blackest mud ever. It's like he's covered in an oil slick, yeah, is what he looks like at one point. But yeah, he starts sinking. Right, I do have here. Yeah, he starts sinking. I guess now he's sad. And he almost gets snatched up by Gamorrek, but just in time, just in the nick of time, Falcor swoops down and grabs him because Falcor is a luck dragon. And that's what Atreyu needed right at this moment, is luck. So Atreyu wakes up and he's wrapped in Falcor's arm. The visual of it with the fur and his weird, like, pearly scales and everything like that, there's something about the visual of it that reminds me of Superman 2. When Clark Kent has, or whatever, Superman has just spent the night with Lois Lane in his Fortress of Solitude, and they've got this, like, furry duvet going on. It's just, there's something about this visual of him waking up in Falcor's arms that always reminds me of Superman 2.
But I wanted to say, going back to, like, the how cool the effects were on the Rockbiter puppetry, I was not as big a fan of the effects for Falcor.
The blue screen for Falcor?
Just when he's on, they're on the mountain and he's talking. With the Rockbiter, they kind of did a good job of, like, matching his lips, yeah, to words. With Falcor, it was, like, so off at certain parts. Yeah. It was like the whoever was running the animatronic was behind.
Yeah, the sync was so bad. Or this is one of those cases where, because this movie was released in Germany before it was released in the States, so maybe all of Falcor's mouth movements had to do with the German dialogue.
But I think it was filmed in English, because none of those other actors, as far as I know, are German. Like, it wasn't dubbed in English.
Yeah. Well, I definitely agree that Falcor's mouth was way out of sync. And later on, so was Gamorrek's.
Yeah.
Gamorrek's was almost as bad. But yeah, the Rockbiter, it's obvious that he was just a puppet, whereas these ones were obviously more complicated, animatronic, relying on electronics to make him talk. Sometimes you just gotta go old school. You just gotta climb inside that head and use your arms to do it. But he also, Falcor mentions that Atreyu's wounds have been dressed. What wounds? Like, he's got a bandage wrapped around his upper arm. When, at any point, did he sustain that injury to the extent that it would require that much of a bandage around his arm?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. Maybe he's slipping and sliding through the swamp.
Maybe.
Emotional wounds.
Emotional from wounds.
Watching Artax go.
And also, how did that actually happen? I'm always kind of, logistics of it all. Because Falcor has quite large paws, I guess. So
yeah.
How did it all happen? How did the wounds get cleaned and bandaged?
Well, that's the elf, those elf people.
Oh yes, the ones that live up top on the
where they are now. So they're the ones that do it. But I don't remember seeing any point that he would have actually sustained these wounds.
The other thing I thought was kind of funny was when Falcor picks Atreyu up out of the swamp, his paws look massive, but when they show him, they're like just clearly he's just like a hunched fixed piece with a neck head. His paws look so tiny compared to the rest of his body.
Falcor says he knows exactly who Atreyu is because Atreyu talks in his sleep, which he punctuates with a very creepy wink. Did either of you notice that? Didn't it look a little molesty? He goes, you talk in your sleep and then winks. Like, you know, it's like, did you just date rape Atreyu? Like,
I never even thought about that.
It was very creepy. But then and then asks him to scratch behind his ear because he can't reach. Or is it because
Tyrannosaurus
is stationary? Yeah, he has the tiny arms. Tyrannosaurus Rex arms.
T-Rex arms. I can't reach behind my ears.
So Atreyu.
Well, he's got like with Falcor's neck. He kind of has like a like how you can't lick your elbow. That's his neck is so long that he. I don't think he could bend it far enough back to get to his.
But he tells Atreyu that he has brought him most of the way to the Southern Oracle, 9,891 miles. So Atreyu still has to walk 109 miles?
Like, uphill both times.
Like, you know, I brought you close. Yeah, 109 miles. That's like a good like 12-hour walk right there at least. Or is that like a full day walk? I don't even know how fast I could walk 109 miles in, but my god, yeah. Thanks, Falcor, for most of the help. But Atreyu says it's good to have a friend again, and Falcor says, you have more than one, look! And this is where we get to meet the old elf couple that we just mentioned. Angie Wook, played by Sidney Bromley, who has 95 credits dating back to 1944. He was in Dragon Slayer, he was in Pirates. He was in, not Pirates of the Caribbean, Pirates from the 80s, American Werewolf in London, and Urgle, played by Patricia Hayes. She has 135 credits dating back to 1936. She was in Willow, A Fish Called Wanda, and 7 episodes of Benny Hill. But they are bickering. And the gate to the Southern Oracle is Angie Wark's scientific speciality. So he wants to show Atreyu the gate through his telescope. And then comes my favorite line that I think I found in the movie. To the wench!
You messed it up.
I fucked it up.
To the winch, wench.
To the winch, wench. Yes. I fucked it up. Yes, that is a great line, though, because it was even one that I had to rewind and go, did I hear that right? To the winch, wench. It was a great line.
That was classic.
Oh, I can't believe I fucked that up. I've got it written down, even. So he tells Atreyu the ominous story about the gate and needing to have worth to get past. And conveniently at that moment, we are treated to a knight in shining armor who is doing just that, trying to get past the gate. And as Angie Walker taunts him from a distance, we watch as the Sphinx's eyes open and the knight just gets vaporized. You know, that was a kind of convenient timing that someone else is trying to get to the Southern Oracle at the same time. But undeterred, Atreyu runs off to try it for himself. 109 miles?
Well, I'd say maybe 50.
Well, I guess he has a couple gates to get through. So yeah. So he, you know, yeah, it's like 40 miles to this one, and then another 40 to the mirror gate. Yeah.
And then 10 miles downhill because you still have to climb down the hill, right?
That's right. So,
it all adds up at the end. Yeah.
So we see the Sphinx up close. Were the nipples necessary on the Sphinx? Yeah. I don't understand why they didn't just do the Barbie thing and just, you know, round off those breasts. I don't understand why they felt the need to include nipples.
Those Sphinx are very well endowed and, like, very... Yeah, very,
a little on
very
the graphic
detailed.
Side, yeah. But I guess if you travel to Europe and you look at art, you're going to see the same things in classic art as well. But Atreyu is just has to be confident, but the eyes start opening and everyone starts yelling for Atreyu to run. You know, the old couple, they're yelling for him to run, and Bastion is once again yelling at his book, and Atreyu just makes it. Now, I'm looking at this, and I'm seeing how the beams hit, like, right smack dab in the center. If he had just moved over, like, 5 feet to the left, wouldn't he have been able to just walk past unscathed? Or would they have adjusted where the beams are going to hit?
Well, it's also that how has nobody else just realized that all you have to do is run as fast as you possibly can? And, I mean, it takes this, it's not like the Sphinx's eyelids open, like, within a second. It seems pretty clear that they open very slowly.
Very slowly. Okay, so next up, Atreyu continues on his quest because he's narrowly avoided being vaporized by the Sphinxes. And he gets to the mirror gate in this snow. It's the fakest looking snow to begin with, I must say. But Atreyu hasn't been warned about the second gate because he ran off too willy-nilly. But it's supposed to be the hardest to pass. Now, I don't understand it. Someone please explain what is going on in this gate.
Oh, I'm assuming that if you're not of pure soul, if you sneak by the Sphinxes, that you would freeze or disappear like the guy in Harry Potter, right? If you fall through it. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but see, okay, so...
The second gate is you're supposed to confront your true self or something like
that's
that.
That's right. And what you see is supposed to be enough to, like, scare even the bravest warriors. So Atreyu sees himself as Bastion Reading.
Thing worse to a skilled outdoor adventurer would be to be just locked up in an attic reading a book.
So are you saying that J.K. Rowling took the idea of the Mirror of Erised from this? Is that what you're thinking? Is
totally, totally. She ripped it off. Or yeah, the Mirror of Desire, right? So
yeah. Well, I just don't understand. So Atreyu sees himself as Bastion Reading, and I'm sure that there's some sort of metaphor here about him not being a warrior but being some scared kid or something. But he has no idea who this kid even is. So he can't even look at this kid and go like, oh, you're saying that deep down inside, I'm just that little nerdy spaz kid that likes to read. Is that, like, he doesn't know. He doesn't know who this kid is. I just don't understand how he would understand the meaning of the reflection. Or is this just all for Bastion's sake? Because Bastion reacts by throwing his book across the fucking room. He can't believe that Atreyu has seen him in the mirror. And so he just throws his book across the room. But Bastion comes to the only possible conclusion. What if they really do know about me in Fantasia? You know, and the plot thickens. Like, I really want to see what is written in this book.
That I was going to say, one thing that would have helped me is, like, is Bastion reading, like, Atreyu approaches the second gate and inside he sees the image of a small child reading named Bastion Bucks? Well, or is it just, like...
I don't know, because at the end, the childlike empress starts screaming Bastion's name, and this is the part that makes Bastion clue in that goes, oh, wait a minute...
I guess that's Atreyu's way of kind of seeing that there is that human child, and then that's the little boy that's going to name and save us.
Yeah, maybe? That's
the two characters and two worlds kind of colliding, right, and coming mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
For the first time.
So at this point now in the real world, Bastion lights some candles. I guess they keep candles in this scary-ass attic as well. And matches. Or because it's all science equipment, did they have like the flint striker?
Yeah, they
have
the gas burners.
Bunsen burners. but he keeps reading because, you know, like late at night at school, once it's gone dark, that's where you're supposed to be, you know, at school, in the attic. But Atreyu has reached the Southern Oracle, so now he's walked 109 miles from where Falkor dropped him off, I guess. Which is a pair of blue sphinxes instead of the gold ones, but they still have nipples, so that's good. And they tell Atreyu that he can stop the nothing by giving the empress a new name. But he can't do it, only a human child can. And Bastion says, such a shame they don't find me. My mother had a wonderful name.
Remember that. So Atreyu gets Falcor to fly him back to look for a human child at the edge of Phantasia, and we're screaming, "Faster, Falcor, faster!" And this is where we get like a solid 5 minutes of Falcor just doing green screen flying. But this is one of those visuals that I remember most from this movie. This is what I wanted when I was a kid. You know, for all the things that I've forgotten about the Neverending Story, sitting on Falcor's shoulders, you know, screaming and cheering and flying over all the landscape. This is what I remember about the Neverending Story right here.
This is where I got the biggest moans and groans from Cassidy. The number one reason is, I guess, with kids growing up these days, they get spoiled and they get the wonderful technology that the movies employ, right? All the graphics. And so that just did not live up to those standards and those expectations that Cassidy has kind of, you know, grown to learn and love and appreciate about movies with special effects. And so it just ended up being a laugh fest.
It would be hard if you've watched Avatar and seen the scenes of, I don't even remember what his name, but flying on the giant alien winged bird
through this
magical CGI'd land that looks better than anything you've ever seen in real life, to go to watching the Neverending Story where it's this weird green screen. I didn't even know.
Let's see. And I was watching it thinking that the effects aren't terrible. Right? Yeah. Like they're not great, but they're not terrible. But yeah, I guess, you know, for a kid that is raised on PS4 video games, if you slap down an Atari in front of them, they're not going to know what to do with it.
It's similar to Last Starfighter, which came out like the same year. But I mean, I'm sure both of those movies were like hailed for their technological advances in filmmaking and that kind of stuff. And now you watch both of them and you're kind of like, yeesh.
So Atreyu gets Falcor to fly him back. And this is where I definitely thought that if they remove the flying and the horse riding and the credits, this movie would be just over an hour long, because they spend a lot of time flying. But the storm clouds move in and Atreyu is bucked off of Falcor, and he ends up waking up on a beach, and he's screaming for Falcor, and Falcor is screaming for Atreyu and flying in circles. But there's this really strange time jump when Atreyu is on the beach and you can see the ruined village in the background, and he's screaming for Falcor, and it cuts to Falcor, and then it cuts back to Atreyu, and now all of a sudden he's in the middle of the village still screaming for Falcor. Like, it just, it felt like a really weird time jump to me. I don't know about you. But yeah, he comes across Rockbiter again, who says how he has failed. But Atreyu insists that he's the one who's failed. Everyone is trying to take credit for failure. But Rockbiter has let everyone that we saw in the beginning die, is what he's what he says he's failed at. So the Nothing is coming, and Atreyu is looking around the village, which have a bunch of murals depicting everything that's happened so far in the movie. So we've got this weird meta moment where a kid is reading this book, but seems to think that he's part of the book. But in the book, we've got murals depicting everything that's happened up to this point. Like, what's going on with these murals at this point?
Destiny.
It's the destiny, it's the prophecy written for ages on the walls. As he's looking at all these paintings, he stumbles across Gamorrik, whose mouth also doesn't sync right, like I said before, who now talks and tells him about the Nothing and him searching for someone named Atreyu, who he lost in the swamps. Shouldn't he know this is Atreyu? Shouldn't he know just by smell that this is Atreyu? Because he was tracking Atreyu.
Yeah, you would think.
And he was tracking Atreyu through a swamp, so there'd be enough smells to throw him off. But he came within inches of biting Atreyu's foot off. But now he doesn't know that this is Atreyu? Like, it would make more sense if he was blinded now or something.
Yeah.
Atreyu at this point just doesn't give a fuck anymore. Picks up a jagged stone and screams at Gamora, "Come for me! I am Atreyu! and Gamorrek leaps at him, and then we cut to lightning flashing in the sky, and then back to Atreyu pinned under Gamorrek, covered in blood, because Gamorrek landed on this makeshift knife that he has. And now the nothing is right on top of us. Everything is getting sucked into it. But Falcor the Luck Dragon to the rescue. And now Fantasia is just a bunch of asteroids. How is anything left at this point? Doesn't this go against the explanation from the Rockbiter in the beginning about how the nothing works? Because he asks, you know, like he's talking about the lake in the beginning. Did the lake drain? No, it just disappeared. Well, so is there a big hole? No, it just, there's nothing. So if this is how the nothing works in the beginning, it just goes away. Why are there still chunks of Fantasia left floating around as asteroids?
Don't know.
It makes no sense to me. But luckily, on one of these asteroids, the Ivory Tower is still standing. And Atreyu gets to meet the childlike Empress. And
I wanted to say, with them refining the Ivory Tower, I was like, they're flying in a linear direction. And it reminded me of, like, when people hope for something that really... Or it actually reminds me of when people watch movies, but they don't realize they're watching a movie, so like they're always asking questions that will later on be delivered to you just purely because it's a story and it's going to pay off. Yeah. But in this situation, they're flying linearly in space, and then Atreyu's like, the Orin will help us find the Ivory Tower or whatever, and yeah. So he starts like praying, I guess. But all that happens is two asteroids move out of the way, and then it's right there. They just kept flying straight.
Well, Falcor's a luck dragon, don't you know?
And that, he's lucky, so he was going to find it anyways.
When those moved out of the way. Yeah, it makes me think of Deadpool 2. You know, what kind of superpower is luck? Well, Falcor proves it right here, just like Domino did. So the Ivory Tower is still standing, and Atreyu gets to meet the childlike Empress, and she asks, why are you so sad? To which he responds, I've failed you. So everything is just all about failure in this last act of the movie. The Empress tells Atreyu that he has brought the Earthling child with him, and he has suffered along with him. I guess we're lucky that Bastion is so passionate when it comes to reading books that he has suffered just as much along with him. Yeah, so Bastion, who seems to assume he was part of the story before, is a little slow on the uptake to realize that it is now actually time for him to speak up. Instead of the screaming and yelling at the book that he was doing earlier, even at the point where the Empress starts pleading with Bastion to call her name, and finally he clues in, he runs to the window of the attic, and he screams, Moonchild? What the fuck? Like, was this his mom's name?
Yeah, I didn't get it. Maybe his parents were hippies in another life before she died, and I don't know, his dad looks pretty straight-laced.
Moonchild? Like, I don't understand that, because Bastion says that, you know, too bad they don't ask me, my mom had the greatest name, and then he screams, Moonchild! I don't understand. Maybe it was a pet name that his dad used to call her. I just don't understand Moonchild, unless this isn't actually his mom's name. But for all intents and purposes, I expect that it is his mom's name. It's just bonkers to me. And now we get Bastion face to face with the Empress, and her in her hand is a single glowing grain of sand, all that remains of her vast empire. But now Bastion gets as many wishes as he wants. And so his first wish isn't to put Fantasia back together or anything like that. You know, it's to fly Falcor.
He's an idiot. You know, you always wish for more wishes.
But he's got unlimited wishes. So I mean, that would normally be what your first wish is for. But, you know, just got to make sure you save that last one to set Genie free. And so he's flying Falcor, and we get like another 5 minutes of green screen flying, and Falcor asks what his next wish is, and Bastion whispers it in his ears, and it turns out to be more flying on Falcor. But this time it's to get revenge on the bullies.
Yes.
Now he gets to fly Falcor in the real world. And it's just kind of this... I guess it's... It makes you feel good about the fact that he is getting his revenge at the end. But the narrator just glosses over it with, Bastion made many other wishes before returning. But that's a story for another time. And there we go. We have the end of the never-ending story.
But before that, I wanted to bring us to our segment, which we call, Whatever Happened to That Guy?
Oh, whatever happened to that guy?
And so, this week's Whatever Happened to That Guy, seeing as we're not going to find out what happened to Bastion in Fantasia in this movie, and Barrett Oliver never appears as Bastion again, unfortunately. He's recast in the second movie and the third movie. So this week's I Wonder What Happened to That Guy is Barrett Oliver. Born August 24th, 1973, he's best known for playing Bastion Bucks in The NeverEnding Story. He was replaced, like Sean mentioned earlier, by Jonathan Brandis in The NeverEnding Story 2.
I was right. Okay.
And by Jason James Richter in The NeverEnding Story 3. Barrett Oliver had minor roles in television. He was in The Incredible Hulk with Bill Bixby. He was in Knight Rider, and he was in an episode of the 80s Twilight Zone, which I love the old school Twilight Zone. The 80s one's not my favorite, but it's still all right. Yeah, he also had some minor roles in film. After The NeverEnding Story, he was cast in the lead of Tim Burton's short film Frankenweenie, which I didn't realize that there was a live-action Frankenweenie. I was only aware of the...
I stumbled across that too. Yeah, the stop-motion animation is the only one that I knew about, and I didn't realize it was based off something, yeah.
Yeah, and then he was starred as the android Daryl in the 1985 film D-A-R-Y-L, Daryl.
Yeah,
which he won a Saturn Award for.
I never know whether it's supposed to be Daryl or like it. Here we go with another Harry Potter reference, but it's just like the OWLs or or the NEWTs, right?
Yeah.
Like I think you're supposed to read it as OWLs, but it's the owls, it's the newts.
Yeah,
it's not the nastily exhausting wizarding tests. Is what I'm a nerd. Go on, sorry.
All right. Oliver's last role was in a feature film. He played Willie Saravian in Paul Bartel's 1989 comedy Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. After filming that movie, he retired from acting and went on to become an antique photography scholar, photographer, and printer. He released a book in 2007 called A History of the Woodbury Type. And so I'm going to read some words that I don't even know what they mean, but I didn't know what the Woodbury type is, so I looked it up, and it is a photomechanical process formed by a layer of colored gelatin pressed upon a sheet of paper in a mold. The mold is photographically made from a negative and varies in its thickness according to the light and dark areas of the negative.
Huh.
I looked up some Woodbury type photos, and if you see one, you'll know what that description is. Hard to know what that means. But
so are these like the sepia tone?
No, they're used a lot for face pictures. When you see these like real detailed black and white usually like a person's face photos, that's what they're used a lot for.
Well, I'll have to Google what those are then. If you say that as soon as you see them, you'll know.
Yeah.
Okay, and that is Where Are They Now? And that is also the never-ending story. So on IMDb, it scored 7.4 out of 10 from the audience. That's 129,019 votes gave it 7.4. The Metascore of 46 from the critics. Rotten Tomatoes audience score of 81%, and the tomato meter from the critics is 80%. So Rotten Tomatoes really likes this movie. What do we think about it? Where do we fall on this? Martin, you're our guest. I mean, let's start with you here. You showed it to your daughter out of love. I'm sure there was probably a part of you that just didn't want to admit that your daughter was right, or do you still, are you still very fond of this movie?
I've always loved it, and so I kept going back to those moments of me finally getting my very own copy of my VHS tape, thanks to my special friend and his special equipment. And so I remember just putting it on and just enjoying the moments of Falco flying through the clouds. And then at the end, when, of course, it was everybody's dream to be able to fly on this dragon. And so at the end, Bastion got to ride it and chase the bullies. So he got that revenge. That all felt really good. And just the magic of it all. And I, because really this was the only kind of magical movie that I remember seeing back in the 80s and the 90s that really captured my attention. And so I was so looking forward to watching it. And then as I sat there, I kept trying to convince both Zonks, Cassidy, and myself that no, it's still as good as I remember it. I tried to hang on to anything I could possibly and have, you know, work, fight against Cassidy's groans and moans, and it's like, maybe she's right, maybe there's. And so then I kind of tossed out a question to her. I said, what do you think the movie would look like if it was remade today with today's technology?
Yeah.
And today's possibilities and abilities, would the story be any different, any more enjoyable? And she still said no. She still said no. I believe if this movie gets remade with today's technology, it would be a completely different experience, a completely different adventure.
I agree, because I feel like there is a certain amount of charm to the fact that a lot of it is practical effects, and even the bad green screen stuff and everything like that. Like the Ivory Tower, not too bad. Like they tried really hard, and all the forced perspective stuff that they had with Rockbiter and Teeny Weeny and in the beginning, it was pretty impressive how they were able to pull off some of these things that and still make them look decent. Colin, what about you? How do you feel about the Neverending Story now?
I mean, I hated this movie for so long that I, having actually sat down and watched it now, I felt like I did appreciate it more. And I would say I told my wife it's not as bad as I remember it being. I think one of the things I noticed is that it doesn't have any great action scenes or like big battle scenes. Which, when I look back on the movies that I liked as a kid, that's all I remember about the movies that I liked as a kid, was whenever people fought. Like, really, when I think about The Princess Bride, the only thing I really remember is the sword fight between the Man in Black and Inigo. Yes. That's like the main Absolutely. Thing that I remember. And so, and as we've done this podcast, that's kind of what I've noticed about the movies that we've gone back to, is all I really remember is the action and the funny one-liners. And this movie, except for the Winch Wench, but I wouldn't have got that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I just think there wasn't anything memorable to me about it as a kid or that really grabbed me.
Yeah, it is very much that if you were to take out Falcor flying, you know, then, you know, all of a sudden you've just lost 15 minutes of the movie, but that's the most memorable thing that... Yeah. You know, we all admitted it right off the bat, but that's what we remember the most.
I did think watching it now as an adult, I thought it was enjoyable, and I appreciated the real life effects and that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't know that this movie could be remade. Part of me thought at first that you could take the story and just beef it up a little bit and add newer technology to the effects and stuff.
Yeah,
but I still don't think that kids today would appreciate this movie the way that kids in the 80s did.
No, and that's a fair comment. I mean, I even think about, like, if someone were to dare suggest remaking Princess Bride, which I have a lot more affection for than this movie, you can't do that you can't change the giant rats into CGI creatures. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a certain charm about having this live action, you know, animatronic animal, and that's part of the charm of the Neverending Story, I think, is the fact that there is all this practical effects to it. Yeah, I think for me, I'm I agree with the critics from IMDb. That 46%, I gotta admit that I found it really slow this time. You know, you take out Falcor flying, you take out the horse riding, you take out the intro, and you've just kind of got a lot of trudging through swamps and having conversations with people that don't really make sense.
One thing I thought that was interesting is that this movie only covers half of the book.
Yeah.
So I wonder what it would be like if they remade it. I know that the second part has like some of the other half of the book, but it still takes some liberties. But I wonder what it would be like if you did a more faithful adaptation to the book.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Well, there we go. That is the Neverending Story. And that's our show for this week. A big thank you to Martin Galba, our special guest this week. Martin, thank you for inspiring our podcast, and thank you for joining us on this journey today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, and thanks for allowing me to revisit this childhood memory that I still hold near and dear to my heart, regardless of what Zongs has to say about it.
And so if anybody wants to find you on the interwebs in the world out there, is there anywhere that they can find you?
I have a Facebook page, an Instagram page, if you just look me up under my name, as well as TikTok. So those of you who are on TikTok, hop on over there, look me up. If you are a fan of Mrs. Brown's Boys, which is an Irish BBC sitcom, it's hilarious. You will enjoy the content that I've got on TikTok.
Very funny.
Otherwise, yeah, Instagram, Facebook, or the usual, so you can follow me on there.
So, okay, and look for the spelling of his name in the episode description. So there we go. If you like that show, one thing you can do that would really help us out on the business end is to hop onto one of the podcast apps that lets you leave reviews, like Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and leave us a 5-star review, because it doesn't even really matter what you say in that review. It's those 5 stars that are important. I've been mentioning Spotify for 7 weeks now and only recently discovered that they don't actually have a rating option, but anywhere else that does let you rate, go on there, give us 5 stars, drive us up those charts, and with all the millions of other podcasts out there, help us get noticed, please.
And if you'd like to contact us or donate to us, you can reach us at by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com, all one word. You can also follow us on all the social medias. We have Facebook, we got Twitter, we got Instagram. Just search for us. I used to like this one. Social media is going to be the best place for you to find out what movies we're watching, as well as Sean's been posting a lot of different memes and stuff related to the movies that we're going to be doing. So, yeah, check us out on there. And
as I mentioned, you can also head over to our website now, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.